comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to Talk Radio Like Nowhere Else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful planet we call Earth, I'm delighted that you are here. If you're not yet subscribed to the K-Files, be sure you subscribe because, of course, this is Friday, and Friday is K-Files night. That means that immediately following the show tonight, I will begin sending out the K-Files, our free weekly newsletter. So if you're subscribed, you'll get it. If you're not subscribed, you won't. And you can subscribe for free right now just by going over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click where it says K-Files, and you'll be there. Now let me ask you a question. Do you have any interest at all in UFOs? Do you have any interest at all in extraterrestrials? Men in Black? The Mothman? Well, if you're interested in any of that, you should be aware of the name Gray Barker. Now, Gray Barker is no longer with us. He passed away in 1984. But he was one of the most prolific and one of the most successful writers in modern UFO history. And he introduced many of the concepts that we take for granted now. He's the one that introduced them to us way back when. And we're going to be discussing Gray Barker. He was very, by the way, enigmatic. And there are people that knew him. Some people that knew him said he considered UFOs to be all bunk, all nonsense, and he just wrote about it to make money. Other people that knew him said that that wasn't the case, that what he wrote about was very genuine, and that he was very genuine about it. And so there's a lot of controversy about Mr. Barker himself. Well, tonight we're going to be talking with Bob Wilkinson. Bob is a filmmaker. We had a filmmaker on last night, James Fox. Tonight we have a different filmmaker, Bob Wilkinson. And Bob makes documentary films. And he has produced a documentary film called Shades of Gray. Shades of Gray is about Gray Barker, and that's not a name that we hear much about these days, but while he was alive, he was certainly one of the spark plugs in the world of ufology, in the world of UFOs, and he was a very prolific writer. And as I said, introduced us to a lot of the concepts that today we take for granted and don't even know that's where it came from, that's the author that introduced it to us. So when we come back from break, we're going to step away for break here in just a few seconds, and when we come back from break, we're going to be talking with Bob Wilkinson about this most enigmatic author, Gray Barker.
Thank you.
Welcome back. As I said, we're going to be discussing Gray Barker. We're going to be discussing tonight a documentary about Gray Barker called Shades of Gray. And we're going to be talking with the documentary's maker, Bob Wilkinson. Bob Wilkinson has produced several documentaries working through West Virginia Public Broadcasting. He produced Rounding Third, which was a history of minor league Watt Powell Ballpark. John Brown's Body, a look at the lasting legacy of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. And Homestead, a history of the Homestead movement in West Virginia. Now, Shades of Gray is a feature-length film focusing on the life of UFO provocateur Gray Barker. Having garnered excellent reviews and awards, Shades of Gray is distributed by E1 Entertainment Seminole Films domestically and Trillion Entertainment worldwide. So it's my pleasure to say to Bob Wilkinson, Bob, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted you're here.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me on the show.
Bob, you know, when I looked at this list of documentaries that you have produced, Rounding Third, John Brown's Body, Homestead, these all seem to be very feet-on-the-ground kind of topics. And then you come out with a feature-length film, Shades of Gray, which I consider, actually, to be a feet-on-the-ground topic, but I think a lot of people would say, well, it's got UFOs in it, so that's not feet-on-the-ground. What pushed you towards Gray Barker? Why did you decide to do a film about Gray Barker?
Well, I discovered Gray Barker reading in a book. It was about traveling in West Virginia, and it talked about different locations and different, you know, historical events and oddities around West Virginia. And in Clarksburg, West Virginia, there was this collection of writings that Gray left behind. And, you know, it's hundreds of folders and, you know, there's 7-8 file cabinets full of things, all the books that he had collected over time, and it's just this wealth of material. And you know, the more you that I dove into it, you get to know a little bit about Gray Barker, and you know, I consider it, as you said, a feet on the ground story too. Even though it involves UFOs and monsters and those sorts of things, I think that today that's become more mainstream, and I don't think people look at it as a topic that's kind of out there in left field somewhere.
Gray Barker, I've done a bit of research on him myself and have written an article about him in the past. I found him to be somewhat of an enigma because, you know, I didn't have the advantage of looking through his own filing cabinets and his own files. All I had was what people who knew him said about him.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can take any one of us and ask all of the people that know us what they think about us, and you're going to hear everything from he is a scurrilous dog to he's a saint. You'll hear everything in between. But he's very enigmatic because of when you look at him through that lens of what people who knew him said about him, he's very enigmatic because on the one hand, you have people that say, you know, the UFO thing was all just to earn money. He didn't even think it was real. And then you have people that say, well, yeah, he thought it was real. He was very genuine about it. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one thing that I would look at is the money situation. If, you know, people do say he was in it for the money. And beyond they knew too much about flying saucers, the book that he had written, he lived a life of poverty in West Virginia, and he spent his last days, you know, living in a little town of Riffle, which is maybe population of 20 people, you know, in his in a trailer in a mobile home there, and spending his last days, you know, drinking and lonely. And you know, I would say that I would have to, you know, that's the end of the Great Barker's life, you know, living a life of poverty. But if you go back to those early days, I have a picture of him as a 15-year-old kid, and he's reading Esquire magazine, and it's an article about flying saucers and UFOs in the magazine. And I think that he did have a sense of wonderment about him, and wondering about these things. But I think he did infuse a little bit of color into his writings. And I think, you know, maybe somewhere along the way he did kind of lose that sense of wonderment and became jaded about the whole subject.
Well, you know, in his defense, it's easy to become jaded about the subject because, you jump into it trying to do legitimate research, you jump into it trying to do... get to the truth as much as you can and to present just the facts, and you run into really tsunamis of hoaxes. You run into people that just have psychological problems, really, and need treatment. And you run into people really by the boatload that are willing to believe anything that comes out, and then they get all upset with someone if that someone brings out facts that show what they believe is not correct, and so it's easy to get jaded.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think you can equate the field of UFO to the great religions, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Muslim faith, and you really do. You have, because there's no tangible evidence, and I think.
Well, there is now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's tangible evidence now. However, up until recently, that was not the case, and you know, the. But even with tangible evidence, you know,
yeah.
Wait, let me tell you what you get into now. This is a big one now, and you're right. And I say very often, don't get religious about this, folks.
It's
very easy to do it. But here's what you get into now. Let's say that you bring up something in your film that goes against what someone out there has already chosen to believe about Gray Barker. Then what you get into now is, oh, well, Bob Wilkinson must be a disinformation agent working for the powers that be.
Yeah, I ran into that with Jim Mosley. He takes great pride into people believing that he works for the government as someone who spreads disinformation, and it's kind of funny to talk to him because he kind of likes that role. And to me, that was with this film. It's kind of, yeah, that aspect was interesting because you got your heroes and your villains, and you know, that's another thing that attracted me to the Gray Barker story, is because with Gray Barker, to me, you have an individual who, to truly understand the early UFO culture in the 1940s, you know, 1947 and 1950s, 1960s, you have to understand characters like Gray Barker. And to truly dive in, and you know, when I put this stuff in the documentary, it's not that I'm trying to spread disinformation. I'm reading his writings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going into his archives. I'm reading his correspondence. Spent hours in that room just going through this material, and you know, you get down to the facts, you get down to the heart of this man when you read his writings and his even his personal journals. You know, I've dug up some of his personal journals, and you have to understand these individuals to understand your belief system. And that way, and it's going to destroy a lot of the things that you have, that the foundation of what you believe. But I think it's important to understand that to go forward.
Well, here on this show, I'm certainly not nervous about belief systems, because I have made it known wide, far and wide, for 10 years. I don't believe anything, and I don't think anybody should when it comes to UFOs. There's nothing to believe. Either they exist or they don't. It's just like a doorknob. It either exists or it doesn't. So when you start jumping into belief, you're using faith, and that's something reserved for religion, and that's not not good.
No, it's not. It's not good. And because I think once you get into a faith and belief system, you're unwilling to accept the truth that could come up along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is where you get dangerous. And I think to really believe something, you have to be willing to, along the way, admit, well, wait a minute, I was wrong. And you need to take a step back. And I think all that does is reaffirm what you believe in the end, if you're willing to say, well, wait a minute, I got to step back from this and really take a look at it.
Well, the facts are the facts, whatever they are.
Yeah.
And the facts say what they say. So what are the facts about Gray Barker? Was Gray Barker someone who actually thought that UFOs were real? Or was he someone who was a gifted writer, used the topic of UFOs and people's natural interest in them just to sort of get famous and make money? Which is true about him?
Yeah. Well, I would have to say that, you know, I can't buy into the money part, because it never happened for him.
Mm-hmm.
He had the one bestseller, and then after that it was pretty much, I think he truly believed in something in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think along the way he became an entertainer, and I think he began dealing a little more in the stranger and stranger stories. You know, he's some of the characters that he dealt with, Howard Menger. He was a follower of Ray Palmer.
As a matter of fact,
Palmer is a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that says a lot about him, you know, that he would base his persona on a Ray Palmer. And
Well, share with the audience who may not know a little bit about Ray Palmer.
Okay, Ray Palmer was one of the early UFO writers, and Ray Palmer wrote for the Pulps, and which was Amazing Stories and things like that. And the Pulps in the beginning were pure entertainment, sci-fi. And but Ray Palmer ended up running into a gentleman named Richard Shaver.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Shaver had the story. He told Ray Palmer about the story of the Hollow Earth and the subhumans. And Palmer liked this, and he began to publish it in Amazing Stories as, This, you know, he's not necessarily telling you this is science fiction. He's saying this is possibly true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this, you know, you be the judge. And that kind of, that whole genre kind of sprung up of the where the sci-fi kind of melded in with the field.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm in the field, I say, you know, ufology. And I think, I think Barker was drawn to that because he was, Barker was really, and I mean, he's an excellent writer. And I think, I mean, if anyone who can make a trip to Clarksburg who's interested in the field to go through those papers and read some of his unpublished stuff, it's really good stuff. It's entertaining and it's fun. And I think that's what Barker's goal was. And I think that's what Palmer's goal was to kind of, you know, bring the readers along on this journey and entertain them along the way.
Mm-hmm. You know, These days, I guess that's a little bit more accepted and understood than perhaps it was in the 1950s and 60s and even up into the early 70s. Because, you know, we know that, for instance, Star Wars is fiction. We know that when we go there. And yet, we are aware that there are probably some elements of fact, some elements of truth that get woven into the Star Wars stories. Maybe very small elements of fact, but, you know, it's entertainment, and there may be a little bit of fact woven into it. Same thing with 2012, the movie that came out this early this year. And, you know, it's science fiction, and yet there are some elements of fact that are woven into it. Most people are able to sort of separate that and understand this is a movie, you know, this is entertainment. At the time when Gray Barker was writing, I'm not sure the public yet had all that sophistication.
I think you're right. I think in the, you know, I find, because you read these 50s publications now and you think, you know, oh my goodness, you can totally just read into it. You can read between the lines and you can tell what's going on. And I think, you know, there was more of an innocence, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe it's technology that's made us all jaded. I mean, if you can go, to, I believe on our website, theynewtoomuch.com, and I've got some of Barker's UFO films posted on there.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at those and you think, you know, you could never pull that off today. You could never show that. I mean, these were films that Jim Moseley used in college lectures, and people, and you know, they were taken around the UFO circuit. But I think the technology has become so advanced that you can make it look like a UFO lands in your backyard and an alien comes up to greet you. And if you go back to the Howard Menger stories, he would have gatherings there at his place. And
Bob, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up right there when we come back, all right? Folks, we'll be back right after this. Okay, welcome back. We're talking with Bob Wilkinson this evening. He is a filmmaker, and he has produced a feature-length film called Shades of Grey, dealing with one of the really most successful writers in the field of UFOs in days gone by. And you were, I had to cut you off in mid-sentence, Bob, and I want to give you the opportunity to finish your thought, and then I want to bring up a couple of topics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about Howard Menger, and I think we were talking about that age of, I think, the innocence kind of where wonderment being lost, and Howard Menger used to have these get-togethers, and he had some people who were Venetians that he said that were his friends and would come and hang out and mingle with the people. And he would also, he was a...
And by that you mean people from Venus.
Venus, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a chemical engineer and had access to illuminescent paint. And so he would paint the bodies of his friends and have them walk across the field so people could see the Venusians out in the distance. And, and you know, people were truly in awe by it. I mean, this is... I'd say Menger was, you know, this late 60s, and people were into that, and they believed it, and I think it's because, you know, in deep down inside, we want to believe.
Well, I think a lot of people do. But belief is more comfortable than knowing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's no work to believing. You just decide to believe. But knowing, you got to work at it. You got to look at evidence. You got to think about it. You got to analyze evidence. You got to collect evidence. There's work to knowing, and believing is just simple.
You might not like what you find. You know, and you might find something you don't like that doesn't line up with your beliefs, and then it shatters that belief.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it does get hard at that point.
All right, I want to bring up Men in Black because, you know, there are, I guess everyone on the planet has heard of Men in Black, and especially now since a couple of films have come out with Will Smith in them. Men in Black and then Men in Black 2. Everybody knows about Men in Black, but I don't think a lot of people know where that term came from, where the concept came from. It was Gray Barker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you see Men in Black throughout. I found that it didn't necessarily originate with Gray Barker.
No, but that's where the term Men in Black entered the UFO stream was through his writing.
Yes, and yeah, his book They Knew Too Much really, that's where he coined that term, and then I think John Keel kind of shortened it to the MIB, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The book, and if you talk to people who read that book as a kid, and some of the folks I interviewed, they talk about They Knew Too Much, where it's talking about the Men in Black and they come to silence you. They say it was truly a terrifying book to them, and. I think Gray Barker did more to kind of perpetuate the idea of the Men in Black than anyone, and he got the story from, you know, a colleague of his, Al Bender, is where Al Bender came to him and said, look, these guys visited me and I'm shutting the shop down, and Gray Barker kind of took over that enterprise of the UFO zine from Al Bender and started the Saucerian.
Well, you know, just because Gray Barker wrote about it, there are people who have already thrown Gray Barker over, and as you know, he was a charlatan, which I don't think is fair. But they throw the baby out with the bathwater, because, as you say, the Men in Black phenomena was not something he invented. The concept or the phrase. The wording Men in Black is something that came from Gray Barker to describe a phenomena that other people were describing. And I've had Frances Emma Barwood on this show a number of times, and she was the city councilwoman in Phoenix who, after the Phoenix Lights, wanted the city council to respond to the citizens and do some kind of investigation, appoint someone to find out what was going on, and was pilloried in the press over that. And yet, in that story, in that saga of Frances Emma Barwood, there was a case where a guy had video of the Phoenix Lights. It was up close and personal video. He called her office. He told her that he had this video, and that he would bring it to her. And she said, okay. And then she never heard any more from him. When she called him back, he said, well, those guys from your office came and picked it up. And she said, I don't have any guys working in my office. And she said, what did they look like? And what he described was Men in Black. They came and said, we're here for the video, and he gave it to them. And so, you know, this is not something that... there may be a lot of fiction out there about Men in Black.
Yeah.
But the phenomena is not fiction. It happens.
Yeah, and I think if you go back, I mean, anyone who hasn't read that book, They Knew Too Much, I recommend they pick it up because, I mean... I think Gray Barker did go out and gather accounts. And one thing that I find when I conducted these interviews and you speak to people, when you talk to someone and they're willing to open up to you and saying, hey, I had this encounter, this is what happened to me, you can't dismiss that because you can see that these people are genuine about it. And sometimes it seems to take a lot for these people to open up to you, to tell you these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And because you don't want the ridicule, you know? It's a lot easier just to keep it to yourself and not to talk to anyone. And so I think that Gray Barker believes what he wrote in that book. And you know, if you want to get into the Men in Black and you want to really study the history of it, the genesis is really, you know, in that book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers.
Was Gray Barker, when you look through all of his files and his journals, did you see anything that indicated that he was ever harassed by the government over what he was writing?
Yes, there was an incident where, and I kind of want to be careful here because I don't want to give away part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an incident where there was a letter written to George Adamski, and the government did investigate it. And Barker, in the end, Barker, he was visited by the FBI, and he ended up smashing up his typewriter and burying it inside the walls there in Clarksburg somewhere. It was a new construction site, and he buried it in concrete so they couldn't find the typewriter. And, I believe that you might find a couple references to him in the Project Blue Book. And so I think in the 50s, you know, they kept tabs on people.
In the 2010s, they do too.
Yeah, they do it even more now.
Mm-hmm.
You can't check out a book from the library without the government, you know, taking a look at you today.
Well, right now, while you're talking to me, and we're broadcasting, part of this audience is hearing it on internet. And just the government computers that are logged on right now, the number of government computers logged on right now is larger than most internet radio shows' entire audience.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, and it's okay. I don't worry about it. I want audience from wherever I can get them. You know, so I'm glad to have the government logged in, but the idea that they used to keep tabs on people, they still do. They still do, and I don't think they view people that are interested in UFOs as much a concern or threat as maybe they did back in the 50s and 60s, but they do keep tabs on it.
Yeah, and I think in the 50s and 60s, I think you got the Cold War, and you got nuclear arms, you know, and I think that played a lot into it. And the fact that we had this battle with Russia, and it was an air battle. I mean, you're talking nuclear weapons, you're talking spy planes and things like that. And I think, you know, to me, that has had something to do with the the heightened security at the time. And I think it has become a little more relaxed today. I mean, you see council women, as you talked about in Phoenix. You had an incident in, I believe it was Texas in the past couple of years.
Yeah, Stephenville, Texas.
And I believe there were government officials talking about that. And so you have almost more of a willingness to talk about it now rather than to suppress everything.
Well, so far, I don't know of any government officials currently serving that talk about it and tell the truth. They do talk about it. However, after the Stephenville incident, they so royally screwed up their spin story, their cover story.
Uh-huh.
And they were so royally exposed as having done so, that since then, they haven't put out any cover stories.
Yeah.
You know, they just, now, they just kind of duck and run and, you know, just don't say anything.
Yeah, the Flatwoods Monster incident, or the Braxton County Monster incident, is also known as, it was the first story Gray Barker investigated here in his, it was just like right down the road from where he lived. It was literally, you know, a 10-minute drive.
Mm-hmm.
And he went and he interviewed the witnesses of it, and Mrs. May, who went up on the field with the kids and saw this mechanical creature land in the field out in the middle of the country on this mountaintop, spoke of the military coming, and they came up the backside of the mountain. They cleaned up the area. They took her clothes, which had hydraulic oil spilled on it, and, you know, they took it away. And so, you know, the spin's always been there, and that plays right into that Men in Black idea that you see on television. You know, what happens when, you know, the giant worm's under the city? Well, Will Smith is chasing him down, and he gets his man, and he erases everybody's memory. And it's the same, you know, it's the same idea.
Mm-hmm. Did Barker, when he talked about Men in Black, did he talk about them having the ability to erase people's memory?
No, he didn't. I think that's something that came up in the comic book that was written. Barker's Men in Black wasn't the delightful individuals you see in the movie. You know, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones would be cool guys to hang out with.
Mm-hmm.
But the characters they play in the movie. But when you get into Barker's Men in Black, these are menacing individuals. They're threatening, they're intimidating, and their main goal is to keep you quiet about what you know. And they're there for to suppress whatever knowledge you may have. That's the Men in Black that Gray Barker wrote about.
I think they're a little too late now. Trying to keep everybody quiet just simply won't work anymore. We have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. We're talking with Bob Wilkinson, filmmaker, and we're talking about his film Shades of Grey, dealing with Gray Barker, one of the really mysterious characters in the history of UFO writing. Bob, do you know if Gray ever attended any like UFO conventions, conferences, anything like that? And if so, how was he received?
Yeah, he was big into the UFO conventions. As a matter of fact, he attended a lot of the early Giant Rock conventions. And, you know, he'd set up his table and his merchandise and sell his zines and books and things. And he was pretty popular. Even the video I found some video of him in the late 80s, or not the late 80s, I'm sorry, the early 80s, like right toward the end of his life, and the rooms were packed. I mean, it was, you know, a pretty good crowd, and some of his friends talk fondly about it, because they say that, you know, he tantalized the crowd, and they, you know, they hung on every word, because he had this wry sense of humor, and like almost a British, you know, comedy type of humor.
Mm-hmm.
That you see on the British television shows. And I think people really enjoyed it. He was there to entertain the crowd, and he did a really good job of it. Even in the end when he wasn't feeling well, I think he was a showman, and, you know, did a great job at it.
Well, even in death, mystery surrounded him, because they never really diagnosed what it was that killed him, but he was hospitalized for a string of maladies, and then finally succumbed and died. Did they ever determine what it was that killed him?
I think the death certificate says cirrhosis of the liver.
Well, and he was a heavy drinker.
He was a heavy drinker, and even in the hospital, I know some of his close friends would say that they went to the hospital to visit him, and he would have a beer on his table, on his tray, eating lunch. And they were like, Gray, what are you doing? You're in the hospital. And they said, well, the nurses say that you can't just stop. You have to keep drinking a little bit each day. And that was the official cause of death. And there's some speculation. Some people speculate that he may have died of complications due to HIV.
Well, and of course, we didn't know much about HIV then.
And especially, I mean, you're thinking 1984, Charleston, West Virginia. And West Virginia is, you know, things do come a little later to West Virginia. The age of internet has kind of sped that up, and, you know, you can't really, things travel quicker today, but in the 80s, you know, things were a little...
Well, if I'm not mistaken, the very first documented case of HIV in the United States was in 1982.
Uh-huh.
And so you're talking about 1984, and, you know, in that 2 years, not much was known about HIV.
I seriously doubt doctors were diagnosing people with the virus. I don't think that they were looking for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was probably well later into the 80s before they were actually starting to diagnose it and you know, put that as a cause of death or an illness.
Mm-hmm. You delved into this guy's life rather intensely. You read his own files and his journals. What do you come away with in terms of what did Gray Barker think about Gray Barker?
You know, that's a tough one to answer because, I mean, I can speculate, but the one thing that I never got to do was speak to Gray Barker.
Mm-hmm.
And so really I can only put myself in his place, and I think there may be a little bit of regret. I think
regret over what?
I think over his position, his lot in life. I mean, this is someone, in my opinion, who could have gone to New York and, you know, Greenwich Village or anywhere like that, and he would have been one of the best writers of the time. And I think that everyone would know Gray Barker today. And, you know, I wouldn't have been making a documentary about this little-known writer,
mm-hmm.
the hills of West Virginia. And I think his career would have been a little more prominent. And so I think that various circumstances held him back. And I think if I were to put myself in his shoes, I think I would look back with a little bit of regret. And some of his poetry kind of touches on that.
Well, yeah, he's little known outside of the UFO community, but, I mean, he had a big impact in the UFO community. I think I can kind of visualize that because no matter what your success is, there's always something that you personally wish you could have done or would have done.
Yeah, and see it too. I don't think Gray lived to see his impact on the UFO field. I think he died before that impact was realized. I mean, here you have the Philadelphia experiment being made into a feature film, and you know, which is he wrote about the Carlos Allende story. He published that, and he got that out there, and he the Men in Black made into two hugely successful films. And then you have his friend John Keel, who he was going to collaborate on a Mothman book with, but they had a falling out, was made into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you have even more today because of those movies. Mainstream America knows who the Men in Black are.
And they know Mothman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I don't think he got to live to see that impact that he made. And I think that happened, you know, maybe 6 to 10 years after his death. And so, someone who went from from having a New York Times, I mean, his book was on the New York Times bestseller list, and then you go to Living Out Your Final Days Alone, you know, back in poverty, and you pretty much die alone. I don't even think many people attended his funeral. And so I think at the end of his life, I don't think that legacy was fulfilled yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really a tragic story in the end, Gray Barker's life, because, I mean, I think there was so much promise there, and he was so talented, and that just, he never got to enjoy the fruits of that.
Well, it is tragic, and yet the world is full of such stories, people that were ridiculed. I mean, you know, Galileo lived out the end of his life under house arrest, you know. And today, the people that had him under house arrest 400 years later have finally apologized. But the rest of the world has championed Galileo for several centuries, but he didn't experience that during his lifetime.
And you know, sadly enough, brilliant people are—that's usually the end of the—that's the tragic end to the most brilliant people's lives. Is, you know, I guess what's the saying goes, the difference between insanity and brilliance is there's not much difference there. And
well, that's true, but it's also true that people all over the world down through history have succumbed to determining truth by majority vote.
Yes.
And, you know, if something is true and the majority say it isn't, that doesn't change the fact that it is true. The majority once said the earth was flat. The majority once said that the sun and the planets all orbited around the earth. You know, the majority, when it comes to determining truth, have been wrong almost all the time.
Yeah, you can build a good case for not following the majority, that's for sure.
Now, some people will say that I am opposed to democracy because of that. I'm not applying that to running a government, because that's all about what do the majority want. So yes, majority rule in government, but when it comes to determining what's true, the majority has almost always been wrong. We'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Bob Wilkinson, filmmaker who has produced a feature-length film focusing on the life of Gray Barker, who has had a tremendous impact on the world of UFOs. Gray Barker, of course, one of the very successful writers in terms, when I say successful, I mean in terms of his works being read and having an impact. He's one of the most successful. And we were just discussing that, Bob. We were talking about the term Men in Black introduced by Gray Barker. Actually, he did some of the early research on Mothman, and when John Keel got interested in it, they were going to collaborate, had a falling out, and did not collaborate, but he had an early impact on the story about the Mothman, and then Philadelphia Experiment, he published that story, and so these are all things that we're very familiar with now, and they came to us from the typewriter of Gray Barker. So he had a tremendous impact, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, he didn't he didn't live to see the impact that he had. As you went through his files and you found things that were not published, did you see anything, did you come across anything that was as potentially impactful as those stories?
I think he began to rehash a lot of things later in his career, as far as the Men in Black and things like that. One of the things that he did publish that was kind of impactful, and Stanton Friedman had mentioned it to me when I spoke with him, he wrote up the Project Blue Book, and he published that and printed it. And Stanton Friedman had, he told me he was a source for the copies of that he would obtain, and he would, you know, so Stanton, even later in life when people were dismissing Gray Barker, you know, Stanton Friedman, who is a very credible researcher, is, you know, using Barker as a resource to pull these materials. A lot of the stuff in his archives, the unpublished things, are short stories and correspondence with either fans or someone who would be sending in a letter disagreeing with him, and he would respond. He had a lot of correspondence with people who would write for him.
People who would write for him?
Yes, he would contact people about investigating stories. John Sherwood was an early writer for him, but he didn't go. He was, and let's see, Roger Paris would do investigative work for him. He would say, "Hey, this is interesting," like the Flatbush incident, or is it Flatbush, Kentucky, like in the 50s, I think, or Flat. I want to say it's either that or Flat Rock. I can't remember. But he would have, you know, Roger run down and investigate that. And he would have contacts to do that. And the correspondence are what I found most interesting. The correspondence between him and Kiel were interesting. That's where I found out that they were possibly going to collaborate on the book, to the extent that Barker had sent him a copy of the manuscript for him to read. And I think there was a little bit of a power struggle there to who was going to take on the Mothman, you know, whose story that was. It's like two reporters going at it to see who's going to break the story. And so I think that the egos may have got involved there.
But a lot of the research and writing that came to us then was done actually by Barker.
Yeah, as far as the bigger stories, you know, the three that you remember, he had extensive interviews with Carlos Allende, the Philadelphia.
No, I'm talking about with Mothman.
With Mothman.
Yeah, he was going to collaborate with John Keel on Mothman, but a lot of the early research in that was done by Barker, wasn't it?
Him and Keel, I think they both arrived around, I think, I want to say maybe even Ivan Sanderson was there, but I'm not really positive on that. Keel and Barker were there about the same time investigating it, and, you know, again, that was a quick drive for Barker. He could jump down there and start gathering some data and some interviews, and the sad thing is the interviews that he conducted are lost. I couldn't find them. The interviews for the Mothman research and the interviews for the Flatwoods Monster research, all that is somehow lost, and I'm not sure that all of his material made it to the library. I think it was lost somewhere along the way. But I would have to contribute the popular version of the Mothman to John Keel more than Barker, just because of the movie and the book that was so successful that Keel wrote. But Barker's story is, I mean, they're similar. They interviewed the same people, and they pulled from the same sources. Barker's book was just re-released here recently. It's called The Silver Bridge, is the name of his book. And he takes some artistic license in it. There's some elements of just kind of, you know, creative writing in it, where he goes off base to kind of give his interpretation of the events, as far as in a really abstract way. It's a really odd little book, and some people say it's some of his best work, and it was hard to get up until recently, until it was republished.
Okay, I'm going to open up the telephone lines and allow our audience to join us. There is one particular person in our audience who, if anyone in this audience, and the audience is in 143 countries, but if anybody in this audience has actually ever met or talked to Gray Barker, there's one individual in this audience that I'm betting has met him or talked to him or corresponded with him. And I'll keep that under my hat, and we'll see if that works out. The telephone line is open, ladies and gentlemen, and the telephone numbers are as follows. Our main number here in the studio, and this will work anywhere in the world, is 623-444-5889. The toll-free number in the USA and Canada is 888-223-4599. If you're not in the USA and you're not in Canada, you can call us at the main number, 623-444-5889, and we would love to hear from you. But if you don't want to make the international call, I don't have a toll-free number that works outside of the USA and Canada, so what I have for you is the flash message option on my website. So you just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click where it says flash message, and you can send me your message. We do have a flash message already. This is from Peter in Colombia, and he wants to know from you, Bob, did your research uncover any interesting information about the mysterious individual known as Indrid Cold? Also, what can you share about the obscure Barker book called MIB Secret Terror Among Us?
Indrid Cold, he does turn up in Barker's book, the Silver Bridge, and he was my facts, I'd hate to comment too much on it because my facts are not going to be too good on that. I didn't really concentrate on that too much. I want to say that John Keel wrote extensively about him, more so than Barker. I'd hate to speak to that. As far as the MIB, The Secret Terror Among Us, that's a really interesting book. It's because it recaptures the history of his writings in The Men in Black, and it pulls from some interesting stories that weren't published at that time. But that was done at his press. He had a little homemade press that he used, and he had some family members that would help him with it, and they would make these little books and put them together, and so I have a Saltharian Publications, and that's kind of like a book that I think he published that in 82, and it was just kind of going back through that mythology. So if you want to of the Men in Black, if you want to get a good history and a glimpse of that, the story that Barker wrote about, that's a great book if you can find a copy. And they do have copies at the Clarksburg Library. And again, I recommend anyone that gets a chance to stop in there. David Halshen is the curator there, and he's a wealth of information, a great guy to sit down and talk to and kind of walk you through it and show you the archives there.
All right, to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Timothy Beckley, and I knew Gray Barker very well. In fact, if it wasn't for Gray, I would not be in the publishing business today. He gave me my first break at the age of 15. He published my first book called The Shaver Mystery and the Inner Earth, which is still in print, and I knew Gray fairly well, and I would consider him a friend of mine. In fact, whenever I gave a conference, I used to promote seminars and so forth around the country, Gray would always come. He was a fabulous speaker, and he entertained the audience, just as you said. And, a lot of negativity has kind of been passed out in his name. He did enjoy a spoof and maybe creating a hoax now and then, but, you know, beyond all of that, he really was, he believed in something, or otherwise, why would he have continued to do that for many, many decades, longer certainly than anyone else, you know? And in the early days, he put out a fabulous, very professional publication back yonder when most zines were a mimeograph or ditto. So I give a kudos to Gray Barker. He was, in his day, a figurehead in the field, and probably still fairly well known. And of course, his book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. Now, this is interesting, if you've got a moment.
Yeah.
When I was in the third or fourth grade, I had a review a book for English class, I guess. And I picked that book to review. Well, little did I know, of course, that not only would Gray become a friend and publish my first book, but when he passed away, I bought a number of books from his estate, and I got the last 50 hardcover copies of the book. So that's a little bit of synchronicity. But I always liked Gray. He was talented, tall, and funny.
Well, and also, I have to tell you, I had no idea that you would be the first caller, but you're who I was thinking of when I said, if anybody knew him.
I probably figured that, yeah.
Yeah. I thought, if anybody knew Gray Barker, I bet Tim Beckley knew him.
Well, I knew him.
And it's great to hear from you, Tim. I'm subscribed to your newsletter.
I get
your email updates.
And I'm glad to see that the film is getting, some promotion, and we'll be getting out there now. Is there a theatrical release plan for the film?
As far as the documentary?
Yes.
No. We were going to go the festival route, but it was picked up through Entertainment One and Trillion, and they're a DVD house, and so we went direct to the on-demand and DVD. It should be available on demand soon.
Uh-huh. Well, it's wonderful that you've kept the his work, alive. And like I say, he did do some. He was a very, very good, speaker. I remember we had a conference here in New York, and geez, we had a lot of people on the program. I think Bill Cooper was here, and I don't know who else now. It's many, many years ago, but Gray was the headline speaker, and he spoke for several hours. They wouldn't let him off the stage. He just had a way of conveying the information. And of course, the stuff he talked about, he might have written about, he might have hoaxed some material and made up some UFO films, but God, who hasn't?
And you know what? I think that that's important in the early UFO culture.
Yes,
I think that was part of it, and that was part of the game.
If it wasn't for some of those films, there'd be a lot of early documentaries out there that wouldn't have any pictorial. When he got up there on stage and he started to present his information, he stuck. He gave the straight line. He stuck to the facts. We could use that word in quotes, certainly, but. He gave it his best shot, and certainly on the Men in Black. Some people say, the Bender, the whole thing was a hoax, but I don't believe it was. And not only that, there were other people that were coming forward who had earlier experiences than Albert K. Bender. In fact, there's still one of the first individuals to get to be silenced. In fact, we reprint the book from time to time if people want it. Was a fellow by the name of John Stewart. John Stewart was an Australian UFO researcher, and the book he wrote, which Gray later published, was called UFO Warning. And Stewart was back even before Bender or around the same time. In fact, I think he was a Bender's Australian representative, but he also had his own UFO group there. And he had a couple of episodes where he was pushed down, I think, a flight of stairs or an escalator in a department store, and his girlfriend was molested by some smelly, invisible creature that materialized from time to time, and he was visited by the MIB. There were at least a half dozen episodes and incidents involving the Men in Black. And, of course, I was on the UFO Hunters recently. I t- took what may be the only photograph of a MIP, if it was a MIP. I mean, it was somewhat strange circumstances and involved actually an associate of Gray Barker as well, Jack Robinson. So that's in my book, UFO Silencers. But, yeah, like I say, if it wasn't for Gray, I wouldn't be talking to you today from New York. And also, too, you know, he actually, I think, outside of the book, how I first became familiar with Gray's work, for many, many years, he wrote a column for Ray Palmer's magazine called Chasing the Flying Saucers. I think it ran for 5 or 6 years, and that can, you know, that contained a lot of information on his actual investigations and correspondence with other researchers, like Vern von Papen, who talked about this UFO crash around, I guess, the same time as the Roswell incident. You know, he wrote a lot of the information for those magazines, some of which are actually still on. I find them from time to time online. You know, so they are available and very well worth reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that they're also available there in the archive. If anyone, I don't know if you've made it to the Clarksburg archive, and you probably speak about it. But it really is.
In fact, after Gray gave up writing his column. I asked Ray Palmer if I couldn't take over the column, and I did a column for years called On the Trail of the Flying Saucers, which I guess is close to Chasing the Flying Saucers. That was another effect that Gray had on me. Anyway, I wanted to share that all with you, and I'm enjoying it immensely. Let me go back and listen to it.
All right. Tim, thanks for the call. Interesting information. You know, like I said, I had no idea whether he would even call in tonight or not, and he does not often call in.
If you go to the Barker Archive, you'll see Timothy's writings all through, you know, Barker's publications, and Barker had collected some publications that Timothy Beckley had written, and so he kept those things, and so I'm sure that, you know, they did have a good friendship there.
Did you find out anything about Barker going through all of his files? Did you find, was there anything in there where you said, "Wow, I didn't know that"?
You know, it was almost all a discovery, because before, you know, I had an interest as a kid, and I've always been interested in the subject on the periphery.
Mm-hmm.
until I started delving into Gray Barker's life, you know, it was all kind of new to me. I mean, I remember the movie Philadelphia Experiment, but I didn't connect anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, this was all a learning experience for me, and to kind of go through that history of things.
Now, he actually interviewed Allende, didn't he, for the information about Philadelphia Experiment?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He interviewed him, and those tapes still exist in the archives, the actual interviews with Carlos Allende. And I think there's a woman from Arizona that published them, too, the interviews. She has the historic documents on CD, different interviews and audio, but the correspondence are interesting because it's really hard to follow Allende when you read these letters. I mean, I think on theyknewtoomuch.com, if you go to our website under the Philadelphia Experiment, you'll see some of Allende's writing. I think that's still up. I had it put up at one point. And you can see he's hard to follow. And at one point, they too had a falling out. You know, Allende, I think, maybe felt betrayed by Barker at one point.
Why so?
And I think Allende thought this was his story, his cash cow, and I think that when Barker published his story, he kind of felt like he deserved whatever financially would come from that. And with Barker's publication, I don't think that he ever really saw anything from it as far as financially. But I think Allende kind of got a little bit angry with him. You can see it in the letters, the private correspondence between the two individuals.
Well, you know, it depends on how you present it, I guess. If you present it as a reportage, then, you know, it is what it is. Newspapers don't pay you for the news. You pay them to read the news.
Yeah, and I think Barker saw himself as a reporter in these cases. When he sat down with Allende, he saw this. I mean, Allende had a great story to tell. And it's a fascinating story if you hear this Allende story. And I think, and Barker published a few other things by Allende also. I'm trying to think of what it was now. He had an annotated version of The Case for UFO by M.K. Jessup, I believe it was.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was a publication called The Case for UFO, and Allende did an annotated version and sent it in to the Air Force.
Yeah.
And Barker published that also. And so, yeah, there is a letter up from Allende to Barker on the website. I was just checking that. You can read it. And to me, this is like the stories in progress. And you can kind of see the genesis of these and where Barker's doing his investigation and the correspondence between the two.
All right, we got about 30 seconds here, and then we have a break taking over. When we come back, I want to get into this a little bit about Allende being hard to follow. And, you know, why do you say he was hard to follow? And we'll get into that when we get back. For those of you who do not know, the story of the Philadelphia experiment came to us from Carlos Allende to Gray Barker, who then published it. And so that's how we know about it. So why was Carlos Allende hard to follow? We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Bob Wilkinson, and we're talking about Shades of Gray, Gray Barker, a man who had tremendous impact on what we today call the UFO community through his writing. Many of the most mysterious things, some of the most mysterious things that we know about and that we talk about, came to us from the writing of Gray Barker, and one of those is the Philadelphia experiment. And you have, Bob, read the correspondence, the private correspondence between Carlos Allende and Gray Barker. And you said Allende was a little bit difficult to follow. What did you mean by that?
When you read his writings, he jumps around a bit, and so you kind of have to. I mean, you have to be really alert and almost take notes as you read Allende, and he's really technical, and so, I mean, when he talks about the ship and when he talks about the government, he's got the numbers that go along with it, you know, like the MJ-026 document says that Einstein's double was on the ship, and it had to be an Einstein double because his story is elaborate, and if you follow it in the letters, it gets very complicated, and I mean, Barker did a good job of, you know, sifting through these correspondence and the tape interviews to pull out the story, which is the Philadelphia experiment.
Did you see any notes in there as to or any writing that didn't get published that would indicate whether Barker thought Allende was being honest and truthful, or whether he had questions about it?
Well, I think if you dig through it, he had questions about Allende's, I would even say as far as his sanity. I don't know that he thought that Allende was, you know, a sane person. And I think, you know, I'm not sure how far Barker was willing to believe the story that Allende had told him.
But when he published, he did not include any of his misgivings as a sort of disclaimer, did he?
No, he didn't disclaim. I mean, if he interviewed an individual and they told him a story, he told the story of that individual without interjecting any of his beliefs into it, whether he believed it or not. And it almost goes back to the reporter. I mean, he reported the story that was given to him.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost up to the audience. And he had an unfair advantage because he had a personal correspondence with these people. And so I think it's fair to say that he knew Allende better than the reader.
Did you, in reading the correspondence between Gray Barker and Allende and between Allende and Gray Barker, did you come away with any kind of impression as to whether the story is true or not?
To me, the indicator is that there's not much physical evidence, and a cover-up of that magnitude would be hard to do. That's almost like, you know, when the trade centers fell, they decided to make it where the public didn't know about it. And I don't know that you could do this without the public figuring out. Because, I mean, you have missing individuals. According to Allende's story, you got individuals who died on the ship. They became part of the ship when it was traveling through time and things like that. And so I would think that the indications are that he had read some of Einstein's theories and principles, and with Einstein, you know, Einstein believed that time travel was possible, and it's hard to doubt a mind like Einstein. And I think what he did, he incorporated some of those ideas into this.
Okay, you're saying Allende did that?
Yes, yeah. I think Allende adopted that. I don't think Barker published much about the Einstein stuff, but in the letters, Allende spoke about Einstein, and almost as he was the mastermind behind the experiment.
Well, I hate to burst your bubble about the government not being able to do a cover-up of that magnitude. They have bunches of cover-ups going on at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And how about justification for a war? Because genocide is taking place, up to 50,000 have been killed, there's mass graves everywhere, and we have to do something.
Yeah.
And selling the American public on that, invading and then occupying, when there was no such genocide taking place.
Yeah.
And then when they didn't find the bodies, when the bodies were not found, keeping the lid on that here in America while the rest of the world had reportage on it.
Right. And at the same time, I think it's easy to sell a story to the American public.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to do that to the American public, but
I have a little bit of doubts about the some of the things about the Philadelphia experiment that have been published and that have been in films. I have some doubts about some of that. I have no doubt that if it happened, the government could cover it up. I have no doubt about that.
Now, I would say this to you. I would say that I don't doubt that the government has tried these things, because, I mean, you see the technology today where they project the soldiers to the battlefield. They have that ability to make it look like the soldiers are there. and they have equipment that they can run from a distance,
mm-hmm.
where they don't even have to be there. They can sit in Washington, D.C. and control armored vehicles over in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't doubt that the government would try these things. I have trouble believing the Philadelphia experiment as in the incarnation that is popularized.
Well, I do as well. But some specific parts of that, and the specific parts, the most specific you've already mentioned, and that is the guys that became embedded in the metal of the ship, and people were screaming and so forth, and they died. And I have some problems with that part of it, simply because they have family. And we're now at a stage where those family members should have begun talking, and none have.
Right, and I believe they were. And, you know, I would almost think there would have been an outcry at the time of the incident. I mean, if you lose your loved one and there are no answers, especially at a time when, I believe when the Philadelphia experiment happened, it was a time of peace. And so I think there would have been more outcry.
Well, unless they were told some other story about how this person died, so they may not know.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. I mean, you could cover it up that way, but in a time of peace, I would think it would be a little harder. And I don't believe there are any publicized stories of the deaths of individuals. And I mean, that was a tough one to.
Well, and then you also have, you know, the ship appearing, I forget where it appeared according to the story, but it appears in another harbor, and then it's back. And there's no stories about people saying, hey, what the heck? What is this?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But, you know, and too, I mean, you see I think it may have been the Swiss that generated the black hole under their city, this big black hole machine, and you have, you know, Einstein has probably written extensively in things that we don't know about as far as time travel and projection and things like that, that, you know, I believe the government would try that, because, I mean, imagine the weapon that you would have at your disposal.
Well, just take a look at the weapons we know about.
Mm-hmm.
And 100% of the weapons we know about are obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And they're obsolete because the true state of the technology is 40 to 50 to, in some cases, 100 years ahead of what we see already deployed. So you look at all the modern weaponry and the gadgetry and people thinking, boy, that's cool, and it's all obsolete. And the way I know that is because the military themselves have told us that.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think we've demonstrated that pretty well in current times. I mean, when you don't have armor and things, I mean.
Well, you know, I've mentioned this before, but during the first Gulf War, there was a press conference on television in which General Norman Schwarzkopf made the comment, all the press were just in awe of these smart missiles and smart bombs. It's the first time the world had ever seen these things that could just fly right into a particular window or down a smokestack. And he said, all of that's obsolete. He said, if Saddam Hussein does not surrender and pull his troops out of Kuwait, we have things to throw at him that he cannot even begin to imagine. So, and in the course of that conference, he explained that the true state of technology, all this stuff you're looking at is obsolete. The true state of technology is 40 to 50 years ahead. And but back to Gray Barker. He had some reservations about the Philadelphia experiment. What about the Men in Black? Did he exhibit in his private writings any reservations about the Men in Black phenomenon?
Mm-hmm. I think you'll see things where he did kind of poke fun at the idea, but I think that with Barker's lot in life, I think that he truly had a reason to fear the fact that you have a secret deep down inside, and the fact that, you know, if that secret gets out, that, you know, you're going to get into trouble. I think that deep down inside he felt that. And I think that once you watch the documentary, I think you'll see, I kind of lay out the reasons he had that reason to fear. And I think the Men in Black was something that resonated with him, and something that was very personal to him.
Did Barker have a secret way down inside that he feared getting out? We'll get to that when we come back from this break. Folks, don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Bob Wilkinson, and we're talking about Gray Barker. Now, as we went away for break, we had been talking about the idea of Men in Black and the idea that you've got a secret and they instill fear in you so that you keep that secret inside. What about Gray Barker? Did Gray Barker have a secret way down deep inside that he feared?
You know, I hate to answer this way, but I'm going to have to say yes, he did. And to explain that secret would be to ruin the film for everyone. So I would have to say that.
Do you cover that in the film?
Yes, it's covered in the film, and it tells, you know, this secret that Barker held inside, and I think once you watch the film, you'll have a better understanding for Gray Barker and the Men in Black that he wrote about and those things.
Was it something
that one, but.
All right, was it something that he ever was threatened about? I mean, did somebody ever threaten him about this secret?
You know, I'm sure he got a lot of threats and a lot of ridicule, and I think that his whole life that he led had to revolve around not letting the secret out and protecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And publicly he went to his grave with it. He never publicly revealed this secret. It was through friends and his personal letters that, you know, I dug this out.
Do you think if Gray Barker were alive today and could see the impact that his writings have had, do you think he would have a different view of Gray Barker? Would he be more satisfied with his success?
Absolutely. I think I can imagine Gray Barker sitting there in the theater watching Men in Black, and I think he would love it. I mean, the fact that it's a comedy, because his sense of humor, it's entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think he would really revel in the fact that he made this impact on the field.
Do you think he imagined at all that down the road after his death that his writings would continue to have impact? Do you think he had any concept of that?
you know, I think during his time the subject just wasn't taken all that seriously in the mainstream, and I think that he was an early pioneer to get it pushed out there into the mainstream. But I think that I saw no indication that he thought that he was doing something that was going to make a lasting impact. And I think that he did it because he loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that he did it to become this, folk hero in the subject.
Do you think that Barker, during his days, viewed himself as a small fry, a small fish?
I think he may have. I think that's part of the reason that he stayed in West Virginia in the Clarksburg area, because at that point he was a big fish. And I think he enjoyed that locally. He was a film distributor. He worked, that was his day job, I would say. He distributed films all across West Virginia to drive-in theaters. And so he was a businessman here, and he was important here. And I think that's part of the reason that he stuck here. And it was almost he was afraid to jump out there to become that small fish, in a sense.
All right, now I'm going to ask you for something. I'm going to ask you a question that's going to call for a lot of speculation, I guess, on your part. But you have read his private papers. Do you think it's possible that the sort of tongue-in-cheek approach he took to some things in his writings maybe was a defensive mechanism, because he realized that there was going to be a thick cloud of ridicule out there if he took it too seriously?
Mm-hmm. That's tough to say. I mean, if you really get down to Barker's personality and what I've learned from his friends and in his writing, when you read his poetry, it's almost like people put their heart into their poetry, and you really see that sense of humor he has. And when I look back over the tapes of him at UFO conventions, and he gives his spiel, and it's funny. It really is. It's funny. It's entertaining. And I think that was just his personality. I don't think it was a defense mechanism. I think that his mind worked different than most normal people.
Mm-hmm.
And like myself. I mean, his mind worked different than mine. And I think that he thought on a different level, and I think that that was just him. And I don't think that, I think the tongue-in-cheek aspect was almost to let you know, hey, this is what I'm writing about. And it goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning of the show, when you talk about beliefs and facts. And I think Barker let you in on the fact that some of it's tongue-in-cheek, but I don't think that a lot of his audience was willing to accept it.
You know, there's a very good example of audience not being able, American audience not being able to pick up on, if you will, the joke involved. And the very good example is when Orson Welles broadcast War of the Worlds, and they said over and over and over during that broadcast that this was a drama, that it's not a real news broadcast. And people just went nuts.
Yeah. It's a great example, and it's like, it's almost like we want to believe so bad that we're willing to dismiss some of the really hard evidence that's right in front of our face.
Well, I see this happen. I get email all the time, and someone on the other side of the world writes an article and gets put on the internet, and it says that Obama has ordered troops into Fort Worth, Texas, and I'm just making, folks, I'm making this up. This is made up. But Obama has ordered troops into Fort Worth, Texas, and they're going house to house taking everybody's guns. Okay, so that appears over on the other side of the world on some internet server. And by morning, it's on every internet server and every blog and every forum and all around the world. And, you know, by noon the next day, it may as well be fact, when in fact, it's something somebody made up. And I see things like that happen all the time. And I hear people say that there would not be panic in the streets if the government were to disclose that we have extraterrestrial contact. I tend to agree with that. There would not be panic on the streets at the level that was seen with War of the Worlds.
Uh-huh.
However, there would be panic on the internet. There would be all kinds of stories hitting the internet that are absolute fabrication, and people would be buying that as real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the danger that we've gotten into in the modern news cycle, I will call it.
Well, Bob, we have run out of business because we've run out of time. I wish we could do some more business here and talk about Gray Barker some more, but we're out of time. Ladies and gentlemen, my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.